Hi, I'm Alice Pelletier, and this is Progressing Planning, a podcast series on the role of planning on fostering change in contemporary society. Today, we'll be talking to Florian Ortega and Emma Spruce about structural gender inequalities in urban resilience planning. Emma Spruce is a teaching fellow at the Department of Gender Studies at the London School of Economics. The research engages in a queer feminist critique of urban inequalities and injustice, drawing on intersectional, transversal, and empirical approaches. Florian Ortega is a manager at the Carbon Trust, an international consultancy helping businesses, governments, and local authorities to reduce their carbon emissions. She has worked on several urban resilience projects over her career and is also an alumni of the RUPS program at LSE. Thank you so much, Florian and Emma, for joining us today. My first question to explore urban resilience policies and gender inequalities will be directed to Emma. So your research is grounded in a queer feminist approach to injustice and inequalities. Could you tell us a bit more about your research and how does gender as a critical concept help us understand inequalities in cities? And do you think that it's something that receives enough attention in urban policy at the moment?
Hi, thanks for inviting me on today. So overall, my research focuses on developing a better understanding of the ways that LGBTQ people engage in placemaking, paying particular attention to how people of diverse genders and sexualities conceptualize and enact the right to the city, which is a right that involves access to existing resources and participation in planning for the future. In relation to the dominant representation of LGBTQ city life, my research makes two key shifts, which are both vital, I think, for considering urban inequality and injustice. So the first shift is that I set out to challenge the common image of LGBTQ urban inhabitants as a metropolitan elite. So this is an association that can be seen in popular culture, but to some extent it's also reflected in the academic research. And one of the impacts of this association is that the ways that women and queers of colour move and make their homes in the city has been given relatively little attention. So responding to the invisibilisation of these perspectives, my research pays extra attention to the accounts of urban injustice that come from cis and trans women and LGBTQ people of colour. The second shift that my research makes is in terms of the site of analysis. So often the focus on an LGBTQ metropolitan elite is paralleled by a tendency to look at LGBTQ lives primarily in areas that are already associated with the gay scene. So in London, we might think about Soho or Vauxhall. And in my research, I kind of sidestep these familiar neighbourhoods to explore the sexual politics and LGBTQ lives in urban areas that aren't so widely considered to be gay friendly. So, for example, in previous research, I've looked at the gentrifying neighbourhood of Brixton in South London, which in the UK context is quite well known as a site of Black British politics, but is much less commonly recognised as a key site of multi-ethnic gay liberation politics. So my research in this area, or in this neighbourhood, pulls from both queer theory and critical urban theory to explore the sexual politics that are attached to gentrification. In essence, I problematise the idea that gentrification is good for gay friendliness and interrogate the ways that LGBTQ spatial politics and urban activisms interact with racialised and classed ideologies of displacement and disciplining. Moving up a scale, I'm just beginning a new research project exploring the significance of gender and sexuality for housing politics across some of Europe's less researched post-imperial cities, starting with Liverpool. This research connects European housing activisms with global dynamics of migration, coloniality and inequality. The new project continues to explore the ways that political claims to space and place are mediated through gendered and sexual norms, but building from the alliances I've seen formed by LGBTQ housing and homelessness projects, I'm particularly interested in exploring what sexuality and gender do to either cement or fracture coalitional approaches to housing justice. You asked me how gender helps us to understand inequality in cities, and at its bluntest, I think that we can't forget that there continues to be a significant gendered pay gap. Women make up a disproportionate amount of the population living in poverty around the world. In fact, in the UK, And even before the pandemic, which has had a particularly negative impact on women, the gendered pay gap was actually increasing in recent years. So one implication of this for a gendered understanding of urban inequality is that women and women-headed families are being priced out of safe and secure housing in the city. As is increasingly reflected in the data on homelessness, LGBTQ folk of all genders also face particular challenges in securing stable housing. So in and of itself, homelessness and housing precarity is a clear sign that our cities are unjust. But housing insecurity also negatively impacts a whole range of other conditions for justice, including access to healthcare, the ability to find work, and the ability to rely on social and cultural connections. I would suggest that without a gendered analysis, it's impossible to really understand the impact of housing inequality and move towards a fairer future. There's also been an upsurge of attention, as we've seen in the last few months, to the kinds of violence that women are exposed to in public space. This raises really important questions about how cities are planned and whose sense of safety or whose vulnerability is prioritised when decisions are made about light, about lighting, public transport, so on. But I also think it's really vital that we think carefully about these problems and how to address them, because the increased securitisation of the city goes hand in hand often with violence against people who are rough sleeping, black youth, sex workers, and so on. To work for urban justice means we need, in my opinion, to think outside the box. One of the ways to start doing this is to value the insights of people whose voices aren't often heard when it comes to planning and transforming the city. I'll say a bit more about that in a minute maybe, but moving on to your last question, it probably won't come as a surprise that I don't think enough attention is paid to gender in urban policy. As we argue for more attention to gender, though, I think we need to really carefully learn lessons from the way that gender has been taken up in other fields in ways that actually reproduce rather than challenge inequality. In particular, xenophobic, racist and classist ideologies have been refreshed by claiming to work on the behalf of women's freedom and inclusion. So we need to keep that in mind whilst we're arguing for greater attention to gender.
So, Flogan, you have worked in various organisations across the world as a planner and as a climate change manager, developing different adaptation strategies to climate change in cities. So could you tell us about your experience working in that field, in the urban resilience field, and your thoughts on these links that Emma made very explicit between gender inequalities and cities, and in your experience working in urban resilience planning and policies, are these kind of inequalities taken into account?
Sure, and thanks a lot for inviting me, Alice. So when you invited me to talk about the link between gender inequalities and urban planning resilience, I was quite surprised about the outline of the podcast, because I think over the last few years, the main focus of the debate on gender inequalities in urban spaces have been around how we can better engineer, how we can better plan, and how we can better design urban spaces so they can accommodate both gender needs and also make cities safer to women. I think we rarely discuss how to include a gender-aware approach when planning cities to increase their resilience to shocks, whatever they are, you know, flooding event, a hurricane, or even COVID-19 would be considered as a shock. So I think for sort of like setting the scene of the sort of like resilience planning debate, I think we need to ask ourselves two questions. The first one, do disasters and urban risk affect one gender more than another? And maybe like starting with the answer to this question, it's not as straightforward. So women and girls are by and large in disadvantaged position in society, but this does not by default translate into worse disaster outcomes. I think in this space, there is a common belief that women are more likely to die during a disaster, and yet men account for 70% of disaster-related deaths in Europe and in the US. I'm just talking about flooding here because they are the easiest stats to get on the topic. And this is driven by several reasons. One of them is their overrepresentation in rescue professions. But in less developed countries, more women tend to die from disasters. So although, you know, you have the same trend as in Europe and the US, men are also overrepresented in risky and rescue professions in these developing countries. Gender gaps in access to information on disaster preparedness, access to public shelters, and limit to mobility seems to contribute more to gender mortality outcomes, putting women at disadvantage. I think there is another, I sort of took this you know, extreme end here, but there is like other dimension of disaster. So you can look at like the economic impact related to disaster, and they have like different effects for men and women, with women largely disadvantaged. Again, still talking about the developing countries context, agriculture is the most economic sector for most of the female employment of these countries, and women farmers tend to be more vulnerable to disaster than male farmers. The domestic burden also tend to increase after a disaster, and women usually bear the brunt of this at the cost of missing out on other income generating activities. There's another factor that I found quite interesting, I guess, which is the lack of access to a bank account. That means that women's assets are less protected than men. It's something that, you know, we forgot. We forget in the UK when our sort of day-to-day, you know, like assets and payment mode is, you know, a phone or a credit card. And then there's another one which I think was worth mentioning, which is related to gender-based violence, post-disaster or post-shock situations. I'm going to take like an unusual example, but I think it's very much of a live example, which is COVID. COVID is a case in point, and surveys around the world have shown that domestic abuse have like spiked in 2020. Jumping significantly compared to 2019. So I've looked into some stats from the UN Women. When the pandemic began, incidents of domestic violence have increased by 300% in Hubei, in China. So this is like maybe the largest increase. In Argentina, increased by 25%, Brazil 50%, Cyprus 30%, and in the rest of the world, you have pretty much the same sort of range, like Singapore, 33%. In the UK, calls to domestic violence hotlines have soared since the pandemic hit, and so the UK has also witnessed this. So this is for the first sort of like, you know, exam question: Does the disaster like impact one gender more than another? And then I guess the second question, especially when you come from the LSE, where I guess we're always invited to understand the cause of issues, I think it's also important to understand like where this is coming from, and it's a vital question, not only in light of COVID but also in light of the greatest challenge of the 21st century. Climate change has led to an increase and prevalence of and severity of natural hazards, floods, earthquakes, tsunami, typhoons, and are putting cities at risk. And when you put this in parallel with the urbanization rate, you know, today it's over half of the world's population who lives in urban area, and this proportion is expected to increase to 70% by 2050. So you have like these two parallel trends, which would exacerbate and reinforce like gender inequalities facing disasters. So I think we're going to touch upon this a bit later, but just as headlines, for me there is like two key factors that, you know, that are basically explaining the gender inequality. The first one is the access to information. In developing countries, women have a lower access to information and communication technologies. And this is, for me, inherently linked with a lower level of education. Lower levels of education can impact a person's access to information, their confidence, their resourcefulness, meaning that women may be less aware and of disaster risk and also less prepared in their response strategies. The second one is the lack of integration of women in decision-making process when planning disaster risk reduction and disaster management. So women and other social groups, so people with disability, may have different perspective and knowledge about the social and physical environment that can help to prepare for natural hazard and improve the effectiveness of the disaster response. And when I was working in Colombia, so now it's been like 8 years, so it was 2013, so quite a while ago, I was working on a resilience and an adaptation project funded by an international donor, the French Development Agency. The project's objective was to boost the technical and institutional capacity of 11 local authorities in Colombia. So we're looking at risk management plans of these local authorities and interviewing the risk management team of these different local authorities. And I guess there's two things that I've noticed now with hindsight and when I was like, you know, brainstorming with myself to prepare this podcast. The first one is that I've met only two women out of these 11 local authorities who are like representing the risk management team. And the second one is that when we're on the ground meeting the early warning community leads. So, you know, the community leads would be the one saying we have like perceived a risk here. They're all like men. And I think this would exasperate, you know, a woman, woman exposure to the future risk. So I think at the time, the gender inequality was not really high on the international development agenda and on the political agenda as well. So our mandate in this project didn't include to assess or to address gender inequalities. And then I left the international development field for a few years. I came back to it just a few months ago, and I'm just like really surprised and positively surprised to see how much this criteria are taken into account. So at the moment, I'm working on a project to improve energy efficiency in South Africa. It's funded by an international donor, and we have like, you know, some monthly reporting to do, and each month I have to report on how the project addressed gender equality. This was to finish on a positive note.
So yeah, on that positive note and on thinking about the ways forward, Emma, how do you think gender and intersectionality as critical concepts can inform fairer urban planning and policymaking?
Yeah, so as is often the case, I'm going to be the killjoy to the positive note, right? Which is to say that, you know, and I've sort of begun to touch on this a little bit already, but for me, one of the really vital things when we call for a greater attention to gender is that we absolutely have to keep hold of the complexity of gender as a critical concept. So in other words, we need to be really on the lookout for the times when we say gender, but we mean women, the times we say women and mean a particular kind of woman, and the times that gender and sexuality are actually operating as regulatory norms on people of all genders. So as Florian was noting, you know, there's a much more complex pattern in terms of who's affected by disaster than we might expect if we were just to kind of guess in advance. And as feminists have argued for decades, including in the development sector, adding women and stirring is important, but it's not enough. Right. And in fact, when we couple the critical concept of intersectionality with gender, what we realise is that one of the reasons add women and stir doesn't lead to transformation is because other vectors of privilege and marginalisation don't disappear within the category woman. So we have this term intersectionality coined by the American black feminist Kimberly Crenshaw in the 1980s, which emerges from this long history of critiques of the white solipsism of mainstream kind of approaches to feminism or to gender inclusion. And so what one of the things that intersectionality does for us is help us see that whilst speaking about a general category, woman might initially appear to be unproblematic, a closer reading shows that invariably the term woman actually means white woman, women who are privileged in most ways apart from gender. And obviously that form of privilege will vary in different geographical contexts, but the question has to be always, how is privilege, how is power operating when we're thinking about gender responsive approaches? So when we hold on to its radical roots, I think intersectionality can really help guide us in work on urban justice and think about the analysis of power that needs to be prioritised there. So in particular, it pushes us to think critically about what kinds of women are able to get a seat at the table and recognise the structural barriers, in particular relating to class and race, that mean that gendered justice is still a really long way off. I think an intersectional approach to gender can also help us to see that gender is a regulatory norm. So in other words, gender operates to divide the population into men and women. And that's a division that lots of people don't see themselves in, right? Non-binary people, trans folk, folk who have third gender identities. And the gender operates as a regulatory norm also in that it prescribes how each of these types of being should behave. So both the binary division and the associated quote unquote ideal behaviours are wrapped up in racial and class hierarchies that were vital for the justification of colonialism and domestic inequality. So what gendered analysis gives us, I think, is the ability to unpack the ways that sexual and gendered norms continue to structure who we think deserves a place in the city and who we think that the city would actually be better off without. And of course, that evaluation of worth is something that is really brought to the front when we think about how responses to disaster are organised. Without this kind of analysis, we can't really understand the ways that public space protection orders, legislation around encampments, the criminalisation of rough sleeping, etc., maintain systemic urban injustice. So to finish, I think that in and of itself, a commitment to urban justice means that it's important to represent diverse experiences of the city and to include a wider range of perspectives. But it's not just that this is, you know, an ethical move, but it's also that marginalised populations, as Florian pointed out, have a lot to teach us about urban planning and in particular relationships to resilience. So marginalised people's creative thinking and problem solving is by necessity unparalleled. And I think there needs to be more of a valuation of the experience that emerges from the daily life struggles and pleasures of the city's more marginalised inhabitants. And that's a resource that could really enrich urban resilience planning going forwards.
Yeah, so Florian, building on what Emma explained about the complexity of gender as a critical concept and the ways forward to better include and value voices that are too often marginalised, how do you think this could be applied to resilience planning in cities? And thinking more specifically about the UK and COVID-19, the Build Back Better recovery plan addresses questions of social inequity. Do you think this program has the potential to improve the gender balance in the country? And more generally, what do you think the key challenges and opportunities are in this space?
Yeah, I think before sort of like answering, you know, the specific role of planning in addressing like gender equalities or inequalities, I should say, I just want to make a point on like access to information. So, you know, we talked about access to information and as a key factor to increase women's vulnerability to risk. And I think I've mentioned that access to information is inherently linked with the access to education. And I think in this area, we've seen a lot of progress. So the gap in adult literacy between genders has like really flattened out over the last 20 years, but it's still like significantly higher among women. So for me, we can't solve the gender dimensions of disaster risk and resilience without addressing the access to education. And I think people may have different ideas when we talk about access to education. One can be very indirectly linked to planning, but in developing countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, which has a much lower urbanization rate than in South America or Southeast Asia, we need to start with very simple things such as the physical access to education. And I'm taking advantage of having this space today to talk about the work that a charity does, which is called World Bicycle Relief. They've been around since the tsunami of in South Asia of 2004. And this organization basically trains bike mechanics and provides sustainable bicycles, which are like purpose-built for road conditions, to individuals and communities in rural areas. And one of the main aim is to get children, to enable children to get to school and to enable like women not to stay at home and to sort of like realize their full potential. So I've been talking to them actually yesterday because I'm going to start on Monday a 1,000 cycling journey across the UK from Cornwall to Scotland to raise funds for the mission to, you know, train mechanics and provide bicycles to rural populations, developing countries. And when I talked to them, it was exactly the day where they're launching their Pro-Woman program, which is called Women on Wheel. It's a campaign that they launched yesterday. And so far they have like trained, I can't remember the number, like quite a number of mechanics. And among this, among the trained mechanics, 30% are men, 70% are women. And something interesting that they told me yesterday is that as a result of COVID, they have seen an increase in childbirth in rural population of these countries, with women staying at home, falling into pregnancy, and this would prevent them from going to school. So they operate mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, like Ghana, Tanzania, and the average time there to go to school in many of the villages where they operate is 2 hours, just one way. So combining a 4 hours journey and childcare responsibility is hardly impossible, but with the bike, it saved them time to do both. The other countries that they operate, and they have like operated in this country for a few number of years, it's one of their recent countries, Colombia, and which has like very different developing issues than sub-Saharan African countries. But the bike is a key instrument for women to use the savings of the transport costs towards food and school fees and just cycle to where they need for either going to school or for their work. So key things, you know, education and access to education. The second one is, and I think this is a key point for planning, is how we can use data when available to make evidence-based decision. And I'm going to take quite a niche example, but I think it's increasingly more famous, which I've taken from a book, which I really recommend, which is called Invisible Woman, which is on snow removal in Swedish cities. So far there in Swedish cities, the approach to snow removal used to be pretty similar to the way it is being done, you know, in the US, Canada. First, the city will plow the major highways, then they will plow the big like surface streets near like the large employment area, and last they will plow the they will clear like the walkways and the bike paths. But there, some researchers dove into the subject in one of the small cities of Sweden, and they discovered that female and male has very different driving patterns. So men commute generally to and from work, and women drove all over to run errands and to take care of elderly family members and children. So they walk more and they are like walking more into the local area and sometimes with kids in tow. So aside from the health and safety, it was found to be worse almost as much to the economy as like, you know, paid work, because of all the sort of like economically hard to calculate work that woman was providing. So I think we need to sort of like when the data is available, and obviously here we're talking about Sweden and data is much harder to get in developing countries, we need to use this data to inform like planning decisions. And I guess the last thing is what Emma was mentioning around this like ideal behavior, which is like preventing women from accessing like participatory and leadership position really. And as a result, they suffer from lack of information, especially when you have like a female headed household without a man. They suffer from lack of information because they are excluded from this leadership position because of this ideal behavior. So they can't, before disaster, they can't have access to this sort of strategy for response planning and early warning systems. During disaster, they need the critical safety information, where is the food relief, where are the sort of like shelters, and following disaster, it's going to prevent them from having access to the resources for the recovery and the rebuilding. So if we take a few steps back with what's happening in the UK and we look at the general dynamic between COVID-19 and the gender inequalities issue, it is clear that the social and economic damages caused by the COVID-19 pandemic has both revealed and worsened gender inequalities at different levels. When you look at job security, women make up 39% of global employment, but account for 54% of all job losses. There are different reasons for this, but an important one is that women are overrepresented in industries more affected by the pandemic, such as accommodation, food services, arts, and the recreation sector. The other reason, which I thought was quite interesting and was pointed out by French President Macron in a tweet last week when he announced the paternity leave reform in France, is that women in vast majority who have stopped working to take care of their children and ensure homeschoolings as children's schooling had gone online for part of the pandemic. So childcare burdens have been more carried by women who some of them had to leave the labor market permanently. At the global level, the need of putting gender equality at the heart of the Building Back Better has been widely recognized. There is a quite interesting research produced by the Institute of Development Studies showing how the SDG, the Sustainable Development Goals, were used as a valuable framework for COVID-19 recovery and future resilience. The goal 5 of the 17 SDG goals is to achieve gender equality and empower women. This study was produced before the Build Back Better plan from the UK and analyzed that the UK government recovery strategy for COVID, it has been quite of a short-term response. The Cabinet Office state that the priority is to save lives while aiming to minimize harms than the restrictive measures, you know, social distancing are causing. The first consideration is health, the second is protecting and restoring livelihoods, and the third is the social effect of social distancing, such as mental health and education. So this is more of a short-term response than the long-term rebuilding. But after this, and earlier this year, in March 2021, the government produced its Build Back Better strategy called Build Back Better or Plan for Growth. And it is very ambitious from an infrastructure and decarbonization point of view. The planned investment in net zero economy is a real step up, with like 60,000 jobs in the offshore wind sectors, 50,000 jobs in carbon capture, usage and storage, CCUS, and up to 8,000 jobs in hydrogen and in industrial cluster that have big components on hydrogen. When you look at it, these jobs are mostly male-dominated sectors, and the plan does say little about how to bridge the skills gap and the education gaps, in fact, across gender. The post-COVID economic plan doesn't say much about closing a gender gap that has worsened. When you look at some ONS data from 2018, it shows quite a big gap in the UK and even more so in London, which has the largest gender pay gap in the UK, with women earning 30% less than men. And the analysis show that this equates to female staff earning £8,300 less than their male counterparts or working 71 days for free. This is very much of an average and really depends on sector. So I think, as a conclusion, it does feel to me that the UK has produced tremendous research on how COVID-19 could be used as an opportunity to boot gender in the heart of the Build Back Better plan, but so far has done not much in terms of reinvesting this research and strategy into its plan.
Thank you for listening to this episode, and thank you to MS Bruce and Florian Ortega for talking to us. For more information, you can visit our blog at this address, www.blog.lse.ac.uk/progressingplanning. Thanks to the Knowledge Exchange and Impact Fund at LSE for sponsoring this episode. Next episode, we'll be talking to Katriana Riedel, Director of Katriana Riedel & Associates, with over 25 years experience working in the planning field within and with local authorities. See you soon.